This is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
Most people don't realize that honeybees pollinate about one-third of our food supply around the world. Honeybees pollinate apple trees and berry bushes, vegetables, melons, almonds, and many other food sources. Honeybees were originally brought from Europe to the United States in 1620. Periodically, since then, there have been occasional die-offs of honeybees, mostly attributed to mites. But according to the scientists, beekeepers, and government agency bee specialists I've talked to recently, there have never been so many empty, deserted honeybee hives as there are now, and no one knows why. The past year in America, at least 22 states have reported honeybee disappearances. Government and science authorities are calling it colony collapse disorder. Beekeepers have reported losses ranging from 60% to 100% of their bee colonies. As winter changes to spring and beekeepers in the colder Northeast can open their hives again, it's expected there will be many more empty hives. Strangely, honeybees have also been disappearing in huge numbers in Spain and Poland. Adding to the European mystery is that Spain has very large commercial beekeeper operations, with at least 3 million colonies of honeybees, similar to the United States. But Poland's 400,000 hives are largely raised on individual farms where smaller bee colonies are separated from each other. If the answer were disease, you would not expect Poland's separated hives to be plagued by large numbers of honeybee disappearances as in Spain and the United States. The European countries with the largest honeybee populations are France and Italy. It might be significant that those two countries banned certain pesticides in recent years because beekeepers there became convinced that systemic pesticides were killing off honeybees. And so far, neither France nor Italy has yet reported the collapse of honeybee hives. One scientist who has been studying honeybees at Penn State University for the past 18 years is Mary Ann Fraser. I ask her how serious she thinks these honeybee disappearances are.
I would say this is certainly the worst die-off that I've seen in my experience working with honeybees. It may be the worst die-off that has ever occurred with honeybees since they've been introduced into the United States in the 1620s. It's characterized by the bees being there in the colonies, quite healthy and strong one day, and then within a week to 2 weeks, the beekeeper goes back, and the bees have disappeared from the colonies. Sometimes a queen and a small number of bees. Oftentimes there's brood, which is the young developing bees. Somehow the bees have just gone, and we assume died outside the hive. There's no evidence that the bees have congregated anywhere, tried to swarm. There's no evidence of that. The bees are just missing. Very unusual kind of situation.
We're talking then about the mysterious disappearance of bees in the millions, and that then must present a problem in doing some kind of autopsy to find out what is happening.
That's right. It is very difficult to find out what's happening. We do have some strong leads about what might be happening, and that has come from beekeepers who we have interviewed at great length and tried to come up with common threads, things that these beekeepers have in common that might explain some of what's happening.
One of those large American beekeepers is David Hackenberg, owner of Hackenberg Apiaries in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Mr. Hackenberg has been raising honeybees for both commercial honey sales and for pollination in Florida and California crops over the past 45 years. He suspects that the culprit in this unprecedented honeybee disappearance is systemic pesticides, poisons designed to stay inside plants and kill off insects that damage crops. Systemic pesticides are not supposed to kill off honeybees, but David Hackenberg explains why he thinks that's the problem.
We moved bees up and down the East Coast. We moved the last of our bees south in October. And a month later, in early November, we went out to look at some bees. And the first location we found that had disappeared, we had 400 hives of bees in it. in less than 4 weeks, they just disappeared. Empty boxes, no dead bees on the ground, no dead bees anywhere.
So it is really a disappearance more than even a die-off because you don't have bodies.
That's absolutely right. The bees are gone. I mean, they've died someplace, but nobody knows where they are. Whether they flew off a mile or 2 miles or what to die, I mean, we just don't know how far out they're going.
In that first disappearance of all of those bees from your hives, how many bees did you lose?
Those beehives would have had somewhere around 20,000 to 30,000 bees per hive. And, you know, if you take that times roughly 400, you're talking about millions of bees disappearing.
What have you seen disappearing since the fall?
We had 2,900 hives of bees here in October, and we're down to less than 1,000 now. So we've lost 60-some percent of them.
Have you ever had this happen before?
No, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to us. I mean, I've seen a lot of things come down the pike. I've been through mites. I've been through fires. I've been through floods. I've had warehouses burned to the ground. I've had 10 feet of water in my warehouse. And I know what caused that. I know what caused the fire. And I know what caused the problem when we had mites. But the problem here is we don't know. I just shudder to see what things will look like by this time next year. In this case, the thing that's really amazing is that other bees will come in and rob out the honey that's left, and there's few predators. Here in the south, we have a hive beetle that moves in. We have a wax moth that moves in and starts eating up comb and stuff. The interesting thing about this whole thing is that none of these things happen. The bees do not bother these combs. They literally sit there for weeks, and you know they don't come and try to take the honey out of the boxes. The beetles don't bother them. The wax moths don't bother them. So it's just like there's something in there that's repelling everything else.
As if the honey itself that was made by all of the bees that have disappeared is giving off something that other normal predators and bees are staying away from.
There's something in the hive. We're pretty sure the honey's not the problem, because once you air out this hive for a day or so, they will take the honey, and if you air the hive out, the beetles and everything else, the wax moth and everything else will take. So there's some toxic odor, some. Fortunately, some of these colonies still living, and we found this here in Florida, and we beat it back to Penn State with it. And looking, basically thinking we had some new virus problems, but found out that bees were full of a fungus, and we think this fungus is giving off some toxins. Personally, I think the fungus is probably a secondary from something else, poisonous pollen or something that was gathered by the bees.
Dave, what would it mean if there was some kind of contaminated pollen in 22 states?
Well, it actually means that there's probably a big problem out here that's probably a lot wider than most of us want to even think about. There's the possibility that there's some new insecticide or some new something that's being applied to crops or being used that is being transferred into this pollen the bees are gathering and bringing back to the hive that's coming up through the plant. You know, remains to be seen, but it sure appears that way because there are new products out there that are systemic, which means that they stay in the plant. So not only staying in the plant, but then it's probably going in the food that we're eating and the animals are eating and everybody else is eating, and really serious ramifications of this thing.
We could be just at the tip of an iceberg here.
Personally, I think that's the case. I've had several people in Washington in the last several months tell me that honeybees are a canary of the human race. Canary, what was used in mines to see whether there's oxygen or not enough oxygen for the miners, and the canary fell over, why it was time to get out. And Penn State has already found that it looks like the immune system has been broken down in these honeybees. If the immune system is broken down, then this stuff's going in our food supply. You know, how much does it take to take out humans? You know, I hate to be pessimistic in this situation, but it just doesn't appear good.
Right, and what happens if all of the honeybees disappear?
Well, first of all, a third of food supply in the United States, and actually the world, a third of food supply is directly related to the honeybee. Fruits, vegetables, nuts, just a lot of stuff that we eat that we're accustomed to having every day is, you know, the honeybee is directly responsible for it. And then there's probably another 30% of what we consume, the honeybees are indirectly responsible for. take the milk you drink. The cows have to have hay. They got to eat clover and alfalfa to produce milk. And if you go back and listen to what Einstein told us, he said if the honeybees disappeared off the face of the earth within 4 years, all life would be gone. And even the wildlife depends on plants pollinated by the honeybees for berries. And so it's not just the humans not going and getting apples and carrots. We're talking about a real big, serious problem.
When you talked with the people in the government and they said that the honeybees were like a canary down in the coal mine, warning if the bird died, then the miners might die, what did the government people say that they thought might be the problem?
We don't know. That was in the preliminary stages, but that's the first time, you know, in my 40-some years of beekeeping that anybody had ever said that to me. I mean, it was something I had never heard before.
And what you mean is our entire food supply, not only in this country, but other parts of the world, could be threatened as the honeybees and other bees are threatened by whatever is killing them.
Yes, that's exactly right. And actually, we're hearing from Europe now that Poland and Spain, they have lost astronomically numbers of bees this past fall. Even with the losses we got now, there's guys that are telling me there's no way that they're going to be able to replace the losses they have this year. So, I mean, if you can't replace the losses you got this year and you have another loss on top of it next year, you're headed down a bad way, that's all.
And especially is it ironic if the culprit is the chemicals in pesticides that have been developed to allow farmers to grow crops and it ends up killing the pollinators.
That's right.
I talk with the acting state apiarist in Pennsylvania's Department of Agriculture. He is Dennis Van Engelsdorp, and I ask him if he expects food shortages this year because of the honeybee crisis and what he thinks worst case might be.
This situation is unique because we're not sure what the underlying cause is.
Would you say that you might have an answer in March?
Then I think we'll be able to rule some things out by March. I would be very surprised right now if there was a very large shortage to meet East Coast needs this year. However, if we can't figure out how to identify this problem or solve this problem, we couldn't sustain a loss like this again. That's what differentiates this loss from past losses like the varroa mite and honeybee trachomite losses, because there's not that number of bees to fill in the void anymore.
And so what is worst case and worst case consequences?
I think that this is a worst case for the beekeepers who experience 80-90% loss. That's terrible. There was one Pennsylvania beekeeper who spent $15,000 to move his colonies to California for almond, and he's bringing nothing back but dead hives. And that's worst case for him.
Mr. Van Engelsdorp at the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture has joined up with Penn State researchers, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Florida Department of Agriculture, and organizations such as Bee Alert, affiliated with the University of Montana, to study what is happening to honeybees. The study group recently wrote that the honeybee colony collapse disorder, quote, threatens the pollination industry and production of commercial honey in the United States, unquote. Even honeybees brought here from Australia to fill in for the disappearing American honeybees have also disappeared. Until there is an answer to what is causing the honeybees to leave their hives and never return, it's possible that eventually there will be honey and other food shortages. Other Earth life disappearances are provoking scientists to call out for the construction of arks to save amphibians and all plant seeds of the world. At least 3 million seeds from most of the Earth's plants can fit into two rooms that measure about 66 by 50 feet. At least that's the plan for what is being called a frozen Noah's Ark, to be built inside a cold mountain on the archipelago of Svalbard, Norway, in the Arctic. Construction begins in March and is expected to be finished by October this year. This Noah's Ark for Earth seeds is being paid for by the Norwegian government in affiliation with the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization's Global Crop Diversity Trust. The fear is that global warming will keep increasing over this century, turning some farmland into desert, flooding other low grounds, and generally changing growing seasons, rainfall, and insects. Many plants won't be able to survive the rapid changes. Some scientists fear that even the Amazon rainforest might not survive into the next century. If we lose the diversity of crops we have now, we could end up seriously depleting this planet's future food and medical supplies. The Noah's Ark seed vaults will hold samples of all the food crop varieties in case plant breeders will have to design totally new varieties to survive on this changing planet. The steady cold temperature of the Svalbard Norway mountain, far enough above sea level to remain dry in rising waters, could sustain frozen seeds for 200 or more years. The scientist in charge of creating and sustaining the Noah's Ark seed vaults is Carrie Fowler, PhD and Executive Director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. Earlier this week, I talked with him about the latest UN report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It says, in worst case, the average global temperature could increase 11.5 degrees over the next 90 years. I asked Dr. Fowler what he thinks the consequences would be for the plant world if there is that much global warming.
Well, the consequences are almost overwhelming, particularly because the most severe impact of climate change is predicted to occur in regions of the world that are least capable of adjusting, where the poorest people on Earth live. We're going to see variations in temperatures. We're going to see more extreme weather events, disruptions in water supplies. The list is long. Many people might think that having agriculture adapt to climate change is going to be reasonably simple and straightforward, to move a particular variety that's growing in one place up several hundred miles north just because the temperatures will be about the same some years from now in that new location. That's not going to work. We won't simply take existing varieties and move them to a place where the temperatures are the same as they are now. If we were to do that, we would expose the plant to different seasonality of light at different latitudes, different day lengths, all kinds of things that would trigger biological responses in that variety that really wouldn't work in the new location. There'd be new pests and diseases, new soil, new amounts of rainfall. So all of the characteristics that go into making up a modern wheat or corn variety are really going to have to be juggled around a little bit to produce varieties that farmers can grow under new conditions. It's going to be a major, major challenge.
This Noah's Ark may be vital to perpetuating food and crops and plants on the earth now.
We think it might well be. We will have to breed new varieties of agricultural crops if we expect to even keep pace with current production levels, much less feed a growing world population.
That is faced with so much change in the climate.
That's right. And I'll mention one other thing, because one of the ways that climate change will manifest itself is through water. Agriculture today takes about 70% of freshwater supplies, but agriculture competes. It competes with the cities and industry, and there are over 200 major river systems in the world that provide water for agriculture that are flowing through multiple countries. The demands on water supplies are going to increase, possibly increasing conflict over water, and agriculture is going to be squeezed from urban users. So we're also going to have to produce agricultural crops that produce more crop per drop.
And the question is, how many populations of humans are now going to have to be moved over the next 9 decades because of sea level rise, while you're trying also to provide biodiversity in plants that could feed these people who are moving?
Well, that's right. It gives you a bit of a pause if you think, erroneously, I believe, that crops can simply be moved around the world.
Could you explain how you're going to build this Noah's Ark and where exactly?
Svalbard, that's reasonably near the North Pole. It's a part of Norway. It's actually under an international treaty, but Norway has sovereignty. If you fly as far north in Norway as you can fly, you need to get on another jet plane and fly about an hour and a half north of there. So if you're going to trek to the North Pole, this is where you're going first. Once you get there, you'll land in a small village There are about 1,500 people that live there year-round. It's very much a Norwegian research and government site. Very cold, as you can well imagine. And it's a mountainous area, and the seed vault is going to be built inside the mountain. We're going to tunnel about 120 meters through solid stone to a place in the mountain, which at the moment is about minus 6 Celsius, very, very cold. And there we'll have two rooms, two vaults, so 24 meters by 15 each. And this is where we'll store about, well, we'll have the capacity to store 3 million seed samples. And each sample would be about 500 seeds. It would be about 500 seeds of a particular variety. And those seeds would be stored in foil packages that are sealed inside boxes. And we'd have the capacity for storing about 3 million such samples, which represent virtually all of the diversity of agricultural crops that can, in fact, be stored as seed. Seed of most agricultural crops can be stored safely alive, kept alive for a long, long time, simply by having the moisture level in the seed reduced to a very low level to reduce biological activity and then freezing them. And if you do this properly, depending on the crop, you can store seed safely for decades, hundreds, and there are even some projections over 1,000 years.
Wow. And how high above sea level would this Noah's Ark be?
Well, it's going to be quite high above sea level, I think 120-something meters. So we've calculated worst-case scenarios for climate change. And if both of the polar ice caps melt, if the ice in Greenland melts, this facility is still going to be many meters above the worst-case scenario where the new sea level would be. And even if global warming takes hold in Svalbard, relatively speaking, this is still going to be a much colder place than most of the rest of the world. We'll still have frozen conditions in the seed vault 200 years from now if our worst-case climate change scenario is true.
When you talk to your colleagues, what do you see as the worst happening?
The worst happening is a melting of the ice caps and significant changes that will cause large social disruptions, particularly in developing countries. We really want to avoid that. And one of the things that the seed vault will do is to provide human beings in the future with the security of knowing that the agricultural options that they need are still intact. We're not saving diversity because it's pretty. This is not a museum or a stamp collection. It's really something that is quite critical. I've been asked the question, well, what would happen if a nuclear bomb drops straight on the seed vault? And I guess my answer is, well, I don't know. I guess suppose it would depend on how big the bomb was. So there are really no guarantees in the world. They're really just probabilities. And so what we're trying to do is provide as robust a form of insurance as possible. But I wouldn't ever want to say nothing can go wrong, because on Earth, as long as human beings are here, something could go wrong.
And without it, we might end up losing biodiversity of the previous centuries up to this date in the face of total unpredictability of what's going to happen in global climate change.
That's right. And of course, we're still subject to problems of natural disasters and wars and civil strife. I mean, we've lost several important and unique collections in the past few years. The Sikh collections in Iraq and Afghanistan were destroyed in the chaos around the wars there. We had a typhoon that struck the National Seed Bank in the Philippines this past September, destroying some of the collections there. And when I say that it destroyed some of the seed collections, I'm really saying that it drove them into extinction. These are varieties that will never exist again, just as gone as a dinosaur is. And what we can expect is that it destroyed diversity, traits, perhaps disease resistance, perhaps a nutritional quality, perhaps a taste, perhaps a color of a flower that will never exist again. And this is something we simply cannot continue to allow to happen if we are serious about wanting to remain on Earth ourselves.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com To see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.